Please be seated. This is our afternoon case, which is case number 69399, Rosenberg Living Trust versus McDonald Highlands Realty. Arguing. Okay, and for the respondents?
Joe Shapiro for Shane now.
Okay, ready to proceed? Oh, sorry. I'm sorry, Mr. Jones, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Randall Jones and Spencer Gunnison here on behalf of McDonald Highlands Realty, Mike Jordan, also respondents and prosecutors.
And how will you be splitting the argument?
15-15.
Okay. All right. Down on the clock, guys. We're ready. And this is a 60-minute argument, 30 minutes for each side.
May it please the court, my name is Karen Hanks, and along with Jacqueline Gilbert and Diana Klein-Ebron, we represent the Frederick and Barbara Rosenberg Living Trust. For ease of reference, I'm going to refer to them as the Rosenbergs throughout my argument. This case deals with a land use restriction in a planned unit community. The Rosenbergs bought a custom home on the ninth hole of the Dragon Ridge Golf Course in McDonald Highlands with the expectation that the ninth hole would remain just that. Instead, McDonald sold off a piece of the ninth hole to Malik, never disclosed that fact to the Rosenbergs, and now Malik intends to build part of his residence on the golf course. Nevada law prohibits this. This court should reverse and remand the district court for the following four reasons. First, the district court erred as a matter of law when it found that Nevada does not recognize implied restrictive covenants.
Do you have any other authority, ma'am, other than Shearer for that proposition?
Yes, Your Honor. The Boyd versus McDonald case is the actual case that laid out the three-part element test where an implied restrictive covenant might exist. And that three-part element test is unity of ownership, continuous and apparent, and the intent of the parties. And so it's our contention that under Nevada law, the Rosenbergs should have had the opportunity to present those facts to the jury to prove that, as a matter of fact, a restrictive covenant existed.
Didn't Boyd involve an easement rather than a restrictive covenant?
Your Honor, the terms are interchangeable. They're used for, it's either implied negative easement, implied restrictive covenant. It could be just easement. Regardless of the term attached to it, the idea is if you're restricting the use of land or requiring land to be used in a particular way, that is a restrictive covenant. And so the terms are used interchangeably throughout the cases. I think Shearer even used the term dedication because it was public land.
Was a dedication of public streets.
Right.
In Shearer, correct?
Right. And the idea behind that dedication was by plat maps, you sold the lands to other purchasers. In other words, you induced people to buy the land because of the surrounding area. And the quote from Shearer really directly relates to this case. It said, the sale by the map was not a sale of merely the land purchased, but also of the surrounding land. And the surrounding land, quote, added materially to the value of every lot purchased. And so the purchaser took, and this is a quote from Shearer, implied covenant to the surrounding land. And that's what the Rosenbergs are arguing here. But whether one exists is not before this court. The district court, as a matter of law, erroneously found that Nevada does not even recognize this concept and does not even recognize a party can bring this claim. That was error. It's been recognized as early as 1913 and later in 1960s by Boyd. That's what we're arguing on this appeal. When the Rosenbergs researched this property, they looked for a particular property since 2009. They narrowed it down to this particular community because of the golf course. They narrowed it down to this particular street. And they narrowed it down to this particular hole on the Dragon Ridge Golf Course. And the expectation of that, when that community is sold as a golf course community, expectation is the golf course will remain a golf course in terms of its use. That's what they're alleging in this litigation. But the district court, as a matter of law, and I want to quote.
On this issue, actually, they're alleging a loss of view across the golf parcel.
Actually,
that's what they testified to, isn't it? And that's what was in their complaint.
Actually, there was no allegations in the complaint that there was a view easement being sought. That's just been arguments of the McDonald parties and
Malik. It was in their testimony.
Your Honor, there were specific questions by counsel for the McDonald parties about, did this affect your view? Did you believe it affected that?
I didn't see a contravening affidavit that rejects that theory or that notion or that argument.
No, and I would not argue that view is not implicated
Why
in some form.
Why didn't the district court get it right when it said that your client were in essence seeking a air and view easement across that property?
Because a view easement would be for land outside of McDonald Highlands. Let me give an example. The McDonald Highlands is abutting Stephanie Street in Las Vegas, Nevada. McDonald does not own anything outside of McDonald Highlands on Stephanie Street. If Stephanie Street wanted to build up a high-rise, let's say someone else, another developer, was building up a high-rise there, and the Rosenbergs wanted to sue and somehow restrict the use of that land outside of McDonald Highlands, then we would be in a view easement issue.
So how does your argument fly with respect to a restrictive covenant when the golf parcel isn't even a part of the golf course? The view of the photo demonstrates that it's outside the ninth hole, away from the green. It's outside the out-of-bounds area. In fact, when I look at that map, that photo, I should say, it's actually not even, a lot of it isn't even grass.
And, Your Honor, that actually doesn't matter for purpose of the implied restrictive covenant. It's actually disputed that
so
it's out-of-bounds.
So help me understand, what is it that the sellers put in their, see if I get this correct, in their CC&Rs and design guidelines? What is the specific provision in both of those that imposes or creates the basis for an implied restrictive covenant on the golf parcel, please?
Well, the CC&Rs do talk about easements and covenants that exist on the golf parcel for properties that abut it. They have agreed to an express covenant to allow golf balls to enter your property. So the CC&Rs and the design guidelines talk.
Those are easements that run in favor of the golf course.
Of course.
I'm asking what provisions in the CC&Rs and the design guidelines impose implied restrictions on the lots outside of the golf course that abut the golf course.
I think the mere mention of them in the CC&Rs and the design guidelines coupled with the plat.
The mere mention of what?
The golf course and how it's the identity of the community and how certain plots of abutting the golf course have to have easements for golf. They have to have open fencing. There's certain restrictions.
Well, are you conceding that there is nothing specifically stated, no language, no sentence in the CC&Rs and in the design guidelines that provide a basis for an implied restrictive covenant on the parcels?
No, what I'm saying is that I think coupled with the plat map, in other words, that's really what's at issue here, is how the community was platted.
You would argue that you can establish an implied restrictive covenant on the basis of a plat map alone?
No. Plat map, the CC&Rs, the design guidelines, the advertising for the community, all of that.
What is it in the CC&Rs and the design guidelines that provides any basis for an implied restrictive covenant? I've asked this question four times.
Right,
give me any section in any of those documents.
If you're asking do the CC&Rs design guidelines specifically state the golf course will remain a golf course in perpetuity, there's no language of that.
Nothing. In fact, there's no representation in the purchase agreement to that effect either, is there?
Well, the purchase agreement wouldn't be able to. That would be Bank of America selling the property. This is only dealing with Malik and the restrictive covenant. But I want to be very clear, though. When we say the plat map and how the community is advertised, that is what the Boyd Court talked about and what the Shearer Court talked about. Those elements, the unity of ownership, the apparent continuous use of the land. It clearly was in operation since 2000, the golf course. It's being used. It's a dispute, Your Honor, that it was out of bounds. It's disputed. But here's what's not disputed. It was part of the golf course. It was part of the ninth hole because McDonald's entity that owned the golf course had to sell it to Malik. So that's where the implied restrictive covenant applies. It's inconsequential whether it was in play, out of play, grass, desert pallet. All that matters is, was it land part of the golf course? And it was, because they had to sever it, and the golf course entity had to sell it to Malik. But again,
I'm sorry, the zoning for that changed before they bought the parcel. How can they not be at least on constructive notice that piece of property is at least potentially going to be used for something other than the out-of-bounds area of the golf course?
Well, that's getting to the McDonald party's lack of disclosure, but...
Lack of disclosure is public record, and it's as is, correct?
Right, but that's a different issue than an implied restrictive covenant. In other words, whether an implied restrictive covenant exists on the property is different from any zoning disclosure being disclosed by the McDonald parties. But this court has held in Western Land, that a zoning change cannot change a private covenant. That a court cannot be compelled to take away a private covenant merely because the zoning of the land changed. But again, what I'm hearing from the questions and what I want to make sure is clear, we're not here to decide whether a restrictive covenant existed on the land. That issue was foreclosed because the district court found as a matter of law that our jurisdiction doesn't even recognize this doctrine, doesn't even recognize a cause of action. That was error.
On the golf course, your implied restricted covenant would be that the golf course can only be used for golf.
Correct.
It doesn't give the Rosenbergs any access easement to go play golf if they want at any time or to walk on the course, correct?
That they would have that by virtue of living in the community and being a homeowner.
Do they have to join or just by being a homeowner?
My understanding is by being a homeowner in the community, they have access to the golf course. It was a semi-public golf course. It's not a private golf course. So my understanding is by virtue of living in the community, they do have access to the golf course. But no, we're not arguing that the parcel sold to Malik in any way affects their individual ability to use the golf course. It's the restrictive covenant is that the golf course can only remain golf course in terms of its use. It cannot be sold like it was and then have residential building on the property and otherwise effectively changing the use of the golf course.
But the golf course hasn't changed. After this purchase, it's still a golf course. After this purchase, the golf parcel is still subject to having golf balls hit on it.
For now, Your Honor. But if this court agrees with the district court and says Nevada doesn't recognize an implied restrictive covenant, there's nothing stopping McDonald from selling another one-third acre and another one-third acre until the ninth hole no longer exists. And you have to remember, when my clients filed the lawsuit, they didn't know what was happening. They just had news after they bought their property that a parcel had been sold. So from their perspective, that could still happen if this court affirms the district court. There's nothing guaranteeing that this golf course will stay a golf course. If this court says the district court got it right and Nevada doesn't...
Wouldn't the facts be different if the land that's proposed to be sold was half of the ninth hole?
No, Your Honor. Well, actually, the facts might be different in terms of the factual analysis of whether an implied restrictive covenant exists, certainly, but that's not what's before this court. The district court here found this doctrine doesn't even exist in Nevada, and we don't recognize a party even bring a cause of action.
I'm not so sure I read the court's order that way.
Your Honor, I can read from the exact quote. It said, as a matter of law, in Nevada, there is not an implied easement or an implied restrictive covenant requiring property formerly owned by a golf course to remain part of the golf course indefinitely. And then he further found that Nevada has not previously recognized a cause of action for implied restrictive covenant. And yet we have a plethora of case law where parties were bringing declaratory relief actions, that was the Boyd case, and injunctive relief actions, asking for a declaration as to an implied covenant existing on a piece of property.
But taken in context, that language is used in the same order in which the district court is making a finding that your client's claim is essentially a claim for one air and site easement.
And that's because,
based on their own testimony.
That's because he was basing it on the fact that Nevada has only recognized an easement for light and air and rejected it. That's
right.
That's the same case as Boyd. That's the Malik and McDonald parties have failed to reconcile that. How can you have the Boyd case that's recognizing an implied restrictive covenant and remanding the case back for factual findings? Because in that case, the district court tried to split the baby and give a different, and they said no. This court said no. An implied restrictive covenant either exists in all or nothing, not in a compromised fashion. And so that would bring me to the part where it only one-third of an acre, not the whole golf course. That's not one of the elements in Boyd. It doesn't matter how much of the land is sold or how much of the land is compromised. This court held in Boyd, it's all or nothing. And they remanded that case back for further factual findings on whether a restrictive covenant existed. That's the same case that extended the Probisco case for light and air easement. So they failed to reconcile. How do I have a case from the Nevada Supreme Court that both recognized an implied restrictive covenant and denouncing an easement for light and air in the same case? And that's where the district court was getting confused. The district court was saying, well, I'm going to buy what they're arguing and saying that you're only asking for an easement for light and air because there is no such doctrine as implied restrictive covenant in Nevada. That's why he was only left with the one doctrine that's been repudiated in Boyd. But that's not what we're asking for. We've never asked for that. Our complaint never alleges anything about light and air or view. Yes, Mrs. Rosenberg testified to questions when she was directly asked, do you believe the view was affected? Yes, but you have to remember, there's two separate parties in this case. And the McDonald parties were sued for failure to disclose the fact that Malik was sold a portion of the golf parcel. And that had it with a separate claim for damages, for the diminution of value to the Rosenberg's property. So when McDonald's party were asking her about effects to view and how it affected her property, she's going to answer those questions, but they're asking because it goes to the claim against them for damages. It doesn't morph what the Rosenbergs are asking for into an easement for light and air as a matter of law.
To Justice Hardesty's point, they're still playing golf there.
Yes.
So the use is still restricted. The only issue raised is they may not be able to see the golf course if Malik builds. Isn't that really the issue?
No.
So isn't view of the golf course at least?
No, well, it's a byproduct, certainly. It might be a byproduct of it because when someone buys into a community and they buy into a golf course community, they expect it to remain, the surrounding land to remain the way you advertised it was going to be. And this affects even people who are buying houses not on a golf course. A person who buys a $300,000 house in a planned unit development who's promised parks, paths, dog parks, the developer is bound by the implied restrictive covenant doctrine once the first lot sells in that property, in that community, to keep that open area and those parks just that way. Because that's what you use to induce people to buy into your community. Not to do a bait and switch. Not to say, I'm going to sell you this grand community with all these open spaces and all these public spaces here at golf course, and then take it away at my own gain. When I can profit from it, I can chip away at it. And that's exactly what we're asking for here. Because right now, there's no guarantee that the golf course will stay golf course in perpetuity because he can just chip away at it. And the fact that it can still be played on the ninth hole, that's not the issue. This court has held that once you sell the first parcel of land in that surrounding community, the restrictive covenant vests. It immediately vests in the surrounding land.
You said on Shear.
No, Your Honor, I base that on Boyd, Your Honor. And actually, that's at page 650 in Boyd versus McDonald. It says it vests at the initial time of severance and absent termination, it cannot be diminished or abridged. And so that's what we're talking about here. It's being diminished. And Your Honor, with respect to, I would like to turn to the McDonald parties, because we do have a second claim, or actually with the Malik fees. By virtue of reversing and remanding on the implied restrictive covenant and allowing the Rosenbergs the opportunity to present this case to a jury, the award of fees to Malik should also be overturned. But independently, those fees can be overturned because the court awarded fees under 18010. And that statute only provides that you can award attorney fees if the action was vexatious or frivolous. And yet the district court, quote, said, I disagree with you that this was a frivolous action. Quote, difficult to say it was frivolous to maintain it. His very findings contradict the only basis you can award fees under 18010. And with respect to the second reason why we're asking the district court be reversed and remanded is that the McDonald parties failed to disclose the purchase by Malik of the golf parcel. They both had a statutory duty and a common law duty to disclose.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about that, if I may. Do you agree that Nevada law has determined that the statutory disclosure requirements found in that statute supersede the common law disclosure requirements? Isn't that the case?
In other words, the statute trumps any common law?
Yes.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
So
yes.
Your claim really is a statutory claim, is that correct?
Correct, and that's exactly how
we let's address the statutory claim. One of the key concerns I have is the decision by the district court that the statutory claim had been waived in the contract. As you know, I presume, there is a statute that precludes the waiver of the statutory claim.
Yes.
Now, I've read the trial record. I've read all the briefs. I asked my law clerk to do the same. And I can find no instance in which you guys Rosenbergs raised the prohibition against waiver in the district court or here, even when it was confronted to you in the answering brief. Could you address that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. We argued our complaint actually alleged an allegation for violation of NRS Chapter 645. And then in our briefs, when they were arguing the as-is provision of the purchase agreement waived that duty, we specifically said you cannot use those as-is waiver, those provisions, to waive the statutory duty. In other words, we made it very clear to the district court, we're not suing under the contract. We're not suing and saying you didn't disclose something under this contract. We're suing under the statute.
Give me the record site, please, of the pleadings in the district court in which you said there is a statutory prohibition against the waiver of the statutory claim.
Your Honor, I do have the citation to the hearing transcript, which is Joint Appendix 2899 through 2969. During the time that I'm sitting down, I can get the exact line item where we did discuss that we were suing under statutory duty. But
well,
that is
that's the hearing transcript.
Correct.
I'm asking, did you raise that in your opposition to their motion for summary judgment, either Malik's or Highland's?
Yes.
More likely Highland's.
Yes, and I could get that citation to you once I sit down with that. And Your Honor, with that, I think I'm left with 10 minutes, so I think I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
If it would be okay, Your Honor, we have a demonstrable exhibit of an aerial view of the property which would be sent out.
Yes, Your Honor, just so you know, this is no different than what appears on page 11 or answering briefs. So this is not a surprise. It should not be a surprise. It's just a blow-up of the monster which is actually embedded in it.
That's fine. Thank you.
Mr. Jones, thank you.
Okay to bring it closer to the bench, as far as I'm concerned.
What would you like?
You can bring it closer so that you can see it.
Right.
Spot. Yes. Should you see it? That's fine with me. Whatever.
Did you need to see?
Yeah.
And if counsel would like to come in front, also you can. While they're referring to it, I don't see anything wrong with that. Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jim Shapiro. I represent respondent Shane Malik. We don't have counterclaims, so I'm going to focus primarily on the easement, the implied easement argument, as well as the attorney fees. I think the real question in this case comes down to what type of easement the appellants are seeking. They don't seem to know for themselves. On the one hand, they assert that it's an easement for use, and yet they can't define the use except to say that it should be used as a golf course. The problem with their argument is the same problem they've had throughout this case. The property in question is outlined in green. This is an aerial photo, and it's clear that the property in question does not include any grass. This is dirt, rock, and shrub. Now, I don't play golf, but I know a lot of people do. And I know enough about golf to know that when you're playing golf, the last thing you want to do is hit the ball into an area with dirt, rocks, and shrubs.
That some of us haven't dirt, rock, and shrubs, but go ahead.
Yes. Well, and admittedly, just like the appellants mentioned, there's an easement for golf balls to come into yards. Very, you know, golf balls go errant. But the intent of a golf game is not certainly to land a ball in a rock area. This area that's in question has not and has never been used for the game of golf anymore than someone else's backyard who has a house on the golf course. In fact, there's no trail that goes through the property in question. Nobody strolls along it. The plaintiffs never testified that they intended to occupy that space. They never testified, I'm going to walk through in the morning and go see the birds. They never testified that they were going to use that as a method of ingress or egress. This property the only people who have ever accessed the property would be the maintenance crews, how often they have to go in and clean up rocks and shrubs. This has not been used for the game of golf. The only use they've identified is we want to play the game of golf and we want to live on the ninth hole. They live on the ninth hole. And it doesn't matter if Mr. Malik builds his home. They're still going to live on the ninth hole. They're still going to be the same distance from the ninth hole to their backyard as it was when they originally looked at the property. What's telling about this is the fact that prior to their interest in the property, Mr. Malik had his surveyor go out and stake the boundary lines. They were marked. Anybody could go out and see the marks. When Barbara Rosenberg was asked in her deposition, did you see the stakes? Her response was, no. Now, why didn't she see the stakes? She didn't see the stakes because they didn't buy the home because they wanted to look at dirt and rocks. That wasn't the view that they wanted. They bought the home because they wanted to see the golf greens, because they wanted to be next to the golf greens. Nothing is going to change if Mr. Malik builds his home. All of this goes to the third element of the Boyd analysis. Actually, it goes to the full analysis of the Boyd case. The question is their case about use or is it about view? The only testimony in the deposition and in answers to interrogatory was that it was about view. But the Boyd case clearly says you don't get view. Now, this court can always reconsider any of its cases. So the question then becomes, should they reconsider the Boyd case? Well, what view, if it is about view, what view is being obstructed? When you look at the configuration, anywhere on this property, even if you had a wall that was 10 feet tall, what's it going to obstruct? It's going to obstruct the view of Stephanie Street. They didn't buy the property. They didn't pay a premium to view cars going up and down Stephanie Street. It's not what they wanted. It's not what they paid for. This, as much as they don't want to admit it, is a case about view, which is prohibited under the Boyd decision. But even if the Boyd decision didn't prohibit an implied easement for view, there's no reason to say that this is necessary for the reasonable use of their property. The third element of the Boyd decision is it necessary for the reasonable or proper use of the property? And the answer in this case is no. They wanted a house by the golf course. They got a house by the golf course. And it doesn't matter what happens in the property in question, that's going to stay the same.
Mr. Shapiro, though, did your clients have any notice at any time before they bought the property that the Rosenbergs were making some sort of claim or whether it's a negative easement or a right to under CC&Rs to this view?
None whatsoever.
So your client's first knowledge is when they got sued on this thing?
It actually occurred in a confrontation. The first time he met Mr. Rosenberg, he went up expecting to have a nice neighborly conversation, and Mr. Rosenberg lit into him and started yelling at him. That was the first time he realized there was an issue.
Okay.
And that was after the...
He had bought the property by then.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Is the thin red line within the green outline parcel, is that the setback? What's the red line?
The red line is an incorrect location of the setback. The red line is actually supposed to be along this edge. So please disregard that red line. It's actually incorrect. I apologize, Justice Pickard. Move that back. So I want to go to the second element of an implied easement as set forth in the Boyd decision. The second element is continuous use, right? Well, again, they want to argue that we have to lump the property in question with the full golf course. And if you take that approach, then clearly people have been golfing on that golf course for 13 years. The problem is, when you look at the property in question, they can't establish open and continuous use. I don't know how many golfers have hit a ball into that area, but that's the only people outside of the maintenance crew that are going to use that area. It doesn't have open and continuous use. They can't establish the second element of the Boyd case because they can't show that people regularly use this property. They can't establish a third element because it's not necessary for the reasonable enjoyment of their property.
Mr. Shapiro, their argument on appeal is that these are factual questions that the district court should have considered before rendering a decision on the implied restrictive covenant question. It does appear that the district court rejected the notion of an implied restrictive covenant in its order. At least that's their argument. Why shouldn't we consider reversing and asking the district court to essentially resolve the factual question about continuous use or their intended use of the property?
Well, there's 2 points in answer to your question. First point is that the district court didn't say there was no implied easement. The district court, and I'm looking at the joint exhibit, or excuse me, joint appendix, page 2466, line 22 through 25, is where the district court said, Nevada has squarely and repeatedly repudiated the notion that easements or restrictive covenants may arise by implication to protect views, privacy, or access to light. It was limited to views, privacy, and access to light. Now, as to your question, was it appropriate for the district court to make the factual finding that it made? The answer is absolutely. Motions for summary judgment do not preclude a district court from accepting the undisputed facts and making rulings upon those undisputed facts. And what undisputed facts did the district court receive? The district court looked at the deposition transcript where they said, the only thing we wanted was the view. The only thing we're given is an obstruction. We didn't buy our property to be obstructed, right? We expected the full view. They looked at the answers to interrogatories where they said the same thing. Now, there was no contradictory testimony. There was no contradictory evidence. And so it was completely appropriate for the district court to accept the undisputed facts, to find that those facts are what they are, and then to make a ruling based upon those facts. I don't see any error in the district court's handling of the case.
We haven't got to attorney's fees yet, but I'll throw that out. Was there findings made regarding the award of attorney's fees as to the legal basis for granting them?
The answer is, the court did make a finding as to the basis of the attorney fees. But to that point, I want to raise an issue. The attorney fee award, according to Weather v. Stewart, 261 P3D 1080, it's a 2011 Nevada Supreme Court case, it's in footnote 1, says that an award of attorney fees after a judgment is a separate appealable order. They never filed a notice of appeal on the attorney fees. The notice of appeal was filed months before the order awarding attorney fees was entered, and so I think it's inappropriate to even consider overruling the motion for attorney or the award of attorney fees because it was never properly appealed. But to your question, in Logan v. A, which is 350 P3D 1139, a 2015 case, this court made it clear that an analysis, that the district court is not limited to one specific approach, but its analysis may begin with any method rationally designed to calculate a reasonable amount so long as the requested amount is reviewed in light of the Brunsdale factors. And in this particular case, my client's attorney fees exceeded $120,000, and the court awarded only about 13% of those. I think that in and of itself is
what was the basis for awarding it? It was bad faith litigation? Or?
Yeah, it was. And the reason that the court limited it is because they said it wasn't bad faith until the motion for summary judgment was filed with the deposition transcripts with the answers to interrogatory that clearly laid out that, look, the only thing they're seeking is prohibited by Nevada law. And the court said at that point it became inappropriate for them to proceed because it was laid out. Discovery had been completed, they had given their answers, and based upon the undisputed facts, the law clearly didn't support their position.
Okay, thank you.
So, Your Honor, if there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer them, and I'll defer the rest of the time to the other appellant, if not.
Sorry, one other question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones, as you're approaching, maybe you could clarify a couple points here. I don't want to get you off your argument, but just a couple things I'm not sure I understand. Opposing counsel said that by purchasing this lot that the Rosenbergs did, they had access to the golf course and use of the golf course. Is there a separate country club there that you have to join and pay dues to have access to, or is it the right of the homeowners to utilize the golf course?
Actually, Justice Gibbon, I was going to bring that point up because I did hear some of the questions, and I think it is appropriate to make sure it's clear. That is incorrect. Counsel for the appellant is incorrect. This is a private golf course. It has been a private golf course. In fact, if the Rosenbergs, the appellants wandered into this area before it was a private property owned by Mr. Mallett, they would be trespassed. That is not open space. It is a part of the golf course. You have to be a member. Buying a lot does not confer any rights whatsoever to the lot owner. You have to be a member of the golf course to be allowed to operate on it. And Justice Segretti, let me just make one other point about it, because this is an important point that I think this whole idea that you're changing the character of the golf course, this is a subterfuge to get around the real issue that they're trying to get an implied easement for privacy, light, and view. And they admit it. And what their counsel has to try to do, and I give them credit for doing this. I mean, when you're stuck with a bad set of facts, you try to figure out some way around it. They tried to argue this other idea of this implied restrictive covenant. Well, first of all, I want to talk about Scheer because I completely disagree with their interpretation of Scheer, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But this idea, it's changing the character of the golf course, that is an absurdity, and more importantly, it's a patent absurdity. This is, the house is configured to take advantage of what? Of the view of the fairway. That's what you want to see. And this, the Rosenberg's house, looks down the fairway. This looks over towards the employee parking lot for the clubhouse. That's their alleged obstructive view that they have no right to. But let's talk about Scheer just for a moment. That case is the linchpin of their argument. Everything lives or dies by Scheer. And as a prelude to that, let me just say this. Does this court want to essentially change the law since the inception of this state to allow implied restrictive covenants or implied easements for light, view, and privacy? Because that's what they're asking you to do. In fact, I thought of the age-old adage of, if it looks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. That's what this case is about, no matter how hard they try to argue otherwise. And so if you talk about Scheer, let me just use this aerial as an example of what Scheer really says. And I hope my voice is loud enough to be picked up by the mic, but I don't want to shout either. But the point here is this. This is what Scheer says, and I'm going to read from their brief, their opening brief about what Scheer says. And the part of Scheer that is actually what it says versus what they say it says. In Scheer, you had a recorded plat map for open space. That's the distinction. So Scheer said, wait, you have a recorded plat map. So let's assume that the parcel at issue, the parcel that Mr. Mallett bought from the golf club, was a recorded plat map. Now you have something recorded that tells the public, this is open space for the public to use. So the Rosenberg, the appellants, being the public, if you will, in this analogy, would have had the right to understand they could use this property because there's a recorded instrument that says this is open space in perpetuity. A recorded instrument, that's the foundation of that case. And boy, does it say anything about Scheer saying anything other than what I just referenced to you. And this is the quote from their brief at page 15. The court found in 1913 that an irrevocable implied restrictive covenant existed because the area was platted on the map as open area. It was a recorded instrument and used to induce purchasers to buy property in that area. So if you're going to, the moral of this story is, if you're going to buy a piece of property and plat it and use that property as an inducement to get other people to buy, you've got to tell them it's open space. They should implicitly understand and have a right to expect that it will remain open space. That is not this case by any way, shape, or form. So that's a part of the contortion that the appellants go through to try to convince you to do something this court has never agreed to do, since the inception of this state being a state. And I think, I would ask you to think about this. You talk about a slippery slope. What does that mean? Where does this stop? What is going to be an enforceable, implied, restrictive covenant? If I buy a house and the guy next door to me, it likes to barbecue every night, and boy, I hate the smell of a barbecue coming over my fence. You should have told me, realtor, that guy likes to barbecue a lot. There's an implied restrictive covenant that says you can't barbecue there. And I know that's an absurd analogy or example, but that's the point. What kind of keg of can of worms are we opening by going down that path? That's why this court has refused to do that in the past. Now, let me just talk about...
Sure. I understand their argument on this particular point to be that the platting of the golf course is equivalent to the platting of the open space in Scheer. It would appear that the difference between the two is the public access to one versus the lack of public access to the other. Is that fair?
Well, I think that is fair. I think that is an incredible, a major distinction. And one is a recorded map that says and tells everybody out there that's looking, this is recorded as open space. And we all know we should be allowed to rely upon that map that's recorded, which brings me to another point. And why?
So they follow up in their argument, though, by pointing out that under the CCNRs, that they do have access to the golf course. They can walk upon it.
They can't. That is incorrect. You have to be a member of the course. You cannot do that. That is just absolutely incorrect. But let's talk about...
I was pressing Ms. Hanks to tell me where in the CCNRs or the guidelines are there provisions that afford to the abutting landowners access to the golf course.
You couldn't find them because they don't exist. But that does bring up another point of a question you asked, Justice Hardesty, about where in the record, and it sounded like you looked pretty thoroughly with your law clerk for a place where they referenced waiver, and I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but the reference that they gave you, I think, was Joint Appendix at 2899, about a reference to where they argued waiver. Mr. Gunnarsson, my partner, was able to pull that up on his computer because we were confused about that as well. It's my understanding from Mr. Gunnarsson, that's the very first page of the hearing transfer, the hearing. It doesn't say anything whatsoever about a waiver as an argument, or excuse me, that you cannot waive the disclosure requirements under 645.252 or 255. So I leave it to the court to look up that and confirm what I just told you. Now, they do talk about those two statutes in the argument that day, but they never once invoke the provision of 252 or 255 that says you cannot waive those issues. And I want to digress to that issue for a moment because my clients are being sued as brokers. I want it to be clear here that with respect to that argument, first of all, they did not bring up the non-waiverability of 645, 252, or 255, and they cannot under, I think it's old Aztec Mine versus Brown, they cannot do that at appellate level, as you obviously know, Justice Hardesty, and the rest of you know. So you can't ambush somebody on appeal and say, well, what about this? But the other point I want to make is, what are we dealing with here? And this goes to the issue of the alleged breaches by my client of being brokers. We are dealing with a very sophisticated appellant. Mrs. Rosenberg has been a broker for many, many years. Now, what does that tell us? Well, that's a factor that should be taken into account, we believe, by this court and was argued below. Secondly, they bought the property, and they talk about, this is, I think, one of the other red herrings from their briefs. They talk about the premium they paid for this property. They go on and on about the premium, implying, it's very carefully worded, that they paid a premium for the property. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever that they paid a premium for the property. They bought a property from a bank that was in the bank's foreclosed inventory. So you could argue they probably got a very good deal, but that's not the issue. They're trying to suggest to you that somehow they paid a lot premium and they should have gotten something back for that.
There is nothing to suggest that is it the case in the record. But the other problem they've got is they, Mrs. Rosenberg, being a sophisticated real estate broker, she bought property that says repeatedly and continually they bought the property not only as is, but what else? Where is? Where is? And a lot of times as lawyers, we focus on the as-is aspect of this, but they bought it where is as well, and that connotes other things like, look at the place where you're buying, look at the surrounding area. This is where you're buying, and they try to say, well, this all these disclaimers only relate to the property. Well, I'd like to walk you through, in the short time I have left, some of these disclaimers they signed. Joint appendix at... Three one two. That is the a letter of intent they signed. Oh, and just so it's clear, the property was rezoned and mapped as rezoned in January 24th of 2013. They didn't close until May, I believe, or maybe even June of 2013. So they had every opportunity to look and see what the actual record showed. This was recorded as real property, as residential property, no longer a golf course. They chose not to do that. And it, in fact, Mrs. the Rosenbergs on May 8th of 2013 waived the walkthrough inspection and released all the brokers and agents from further responsibility of liability in any manner. That's part of the appendix of our motion for summary judgment. But then on February 20th, this is again joint appendix at 312, they signed a letter of intent that says 15 conditions of property. It is buyer's obligation to conduct all necessary studies, included but not limited to, et cetera, zoning and CC&Rs. Buyer shall purchase the property as is and where is with all faults. That's a letter of intent. Then the purchase agreement. Let's look at what they signed in there. So the purchase agreement has a section that says, paragraph 22, remember this is a sophisticated real estate purchaser, waiver of claims. The property will be sold as is, where is, without any representations or warranties, et cetera, buyer agrees to satisfy himself to the condition, as to the condition of the property, and et cetera, has read and understand and agrees to each and every provision of this page unless a particular paragraph is modified by addendum or contradiction. Now, the next page of that appendix says, the buyer waives all claims against brokers or their agents, specifically incorporating the brokers and agents into that disclaimer, and goes on to say, as to zoning of the property, that's a specific item number F contained in there, number H, factors related to buyer's failure to conduct walkthroughs or inspections. Buyer assumes full responsibility for the foregoing and agrees to conduct such tests, walkthroughs, inspections, and research as buyer deems necessary. In any event, buyer's liability will be limited under any and all circumstances to the amount of the broker's commission received in the transaction. Now, that's interesting. Of course.
Wouldn't you agree that the contractual provision that precludes or establishes a waiver of a claim associated with zoning against the broker would violate 645255 if that had been alleged?
You know, I've thought about that very question, Your Honor. That's a really interesting question to me. And I can only tell you what seems to make sense to me. You all get to make the hard choices. Where you have a sophisticated real estate broker who buys REO property, as is where is, signs multiple disclosures and disclaimers. And I haven't even got to the good ones yet in the addendum, which is a record on appeal at 0348. All specifically referring to the broker and the broker's agents. So the question then becomes, at a certain point, remember, they walked away. They said, we're done. We don't have to look anymore. They had every opportunity. This was recorded, Matt. And so they can come back and say, gotcha.
Well, me ask you to think about the question I posed in the context of what I'll relay are my understanding of the facts from the record regarding, is it Doiron? How do you pronounce that? Doiron, the real estate agent?
Yes.
Doiron?
That's my understanding as well.
So we'll go with that. How's that?
Right, that sounds good to me.
Is it the case that Mr. Doiron assisted the Maleks in their rezoning request with the city of Henderson?
I'm sorry, Dorian. It's actually Mrs. It's Michael. That's what threw me off. It's a woman, but her first name is Michael. Mrs. Dorian, as I understand it, was involved at the beginning of that process, and according to her testimony, was not really involved in it later on. So, but I don't want to certainly mislead the court. I believe she had some involvement in the process.
A couple of key factors from the record, as I understand it.
Okay.
One is that the some assistance was provided to the Maleks by the broker to process the rezoning request through the city of Henderson that allowed the golf parcel to be rezoned.
Right.
Secondly, it's my understanding from the record that was provided that Doiron was also representing Bank of America in the sale to Rosenberg Trust.
That's correct.
Third, that the rezoning was accomplished in February of 2013, but that fact was not recorded until June of 2013. And next, as I understand it from the record, Malik closed escrow on his parcel, on the golf parcel, in April of 2013. And then lastly, as I understand it, the Rosenberg Trust entered into the contract in February of 2013, closed escrow in early March of 2013.
I think they closed actually a little later.
Doiron provided to the Rosenberg Trust a document that represented to the Rosenbergs that the status of zoning as she existed in 2010 would have shown that that zoned parcel, golf parcel, was not to be used for residential purposes. I'm a little troubled by the fact that a document that expresses the status of zoning as she exists in 2010 is markedly different and known by the realtor to be different in 2013.
I understand your point, and I think that's a very good question. The document we're talking about is 348, Joint Appendix 348.
Right.
I assume I should finish answering your question.
Yes, answer.
I don't know why she, whether she slipped her mind or she didn't think it was relevant or whatever. She obviously didn't do it, and that document says, the information, this is, I'm quoting from the document in that the reference, the information is current and plotted as of February 10, 2010. So it tells them right in the document. It's old information. Master plan designations and zoning clarifications, ordinance and regulations adopted pursuant to the master plan are subject to change. You may obtain more current information regarding, and then tells you where to go. So, and I know that doesn't answer the question you have specifically, but it does. You know, here's the way I have a problem with what the Rosenbergs did about this. They know what they're doing. We know that. They sign numerous disclaimers that tell them specifically about as is, whereas, and reference zoning and researching the records. The record by the time they closed had been changed. The map hadn't been filed. But at the city of Henderson, this was all subject to a public hearing. It had a public hearing notice, and there was no objections to changing character of that property and reparceling it. But so the question then becomes, do you need to disclose something that is legally insignificant? Because it all depends and comes back to this issue of what are they claiming here? They're asking for an implied easement which they, I mean, as much as they try to deny it, they can't deny it, for light, privacy, and view. So it's essentially taking form over substance to say, I didn't tell you about something that was essentially meaningless. And so that's why I'm troubled about this set of facts that you just outlined, Justice.
Mr. Jones, can I ask you, though, as a follow-up to that, I mean, I did read that in the materials in the statute in question. It kind of sounds like a genuine issue of material fact, isn't it? Tell me why you don't think it is.
Because the excuse the repetition of this word, the linchpin of that argument is grounded in a matter of law.
So it's not material, is your argument?
It cannot be, because Nevada has never recognized an implied easement for light, view, and privacy. And without that, what was the disclosure? Now, I understand, I said, well, I wanted to know about that. But it is, as a matter of law, of no consequence. And I would just, one final point, and this came up in Mrs. Rosenberg's deposition. She referenced their only expert, because they talk about this $2.3 million. And in that expert report, the only thing he bases his damage estimate on is light, view, and privacy. So it all comes back to that. And that's why, as much as there might be some troubling facts, it's like saying, you didn't tell me about something that I couldn't do anything about, it was of no consequence. Now they say, well, I might not have bought the property. Well, there's an issue that maybe they wouldn't have. But do you have an obligation to tell them? It's kind of my barbecue analogy. Where does that stop? Do I have to tell them that there's a bunch of kids that live next door and they can be loud sometimes and have parties? And I think that's such a slippery slope that you'd have to change the law of the state of Nevada to allow this kind of a claim before you could ever get to a genuine issue of material fact.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Sankey, you have 10 minutes.
I'm going to work my way backwards so it makes sense, Your Honors. At the summary judgment phase, they admitted that materiality was not an issue, and I want to quote Mr. Gunnarsson. He was the gentleman who argued. And this is at Joint Appendix 2964. First of all, materiality is not an issue in our motion. That would, whether or not it is or is not material, is ultimately going to be a question of fact. And they didn't argue that below because they were arguing that regardless of whether it was a material issue, a fact that had to be disclosed, the Rosenbergs waived it. And that's where this is where we are on appeal. And the district court erred as a matter of law to say that the Rosenbergs, both under statutory and common law, can waive a duty to disclose a material fact. And they tacitly admit it was a material fact in their briefs on appeal because, again, they don't argue it wasn't material, we didn't have to disclose it. They argue the Rosenbergs waived it. And that is not permissible under Nevada law. Your Honor, earlier in my argument, asked me for the citation where we were talking about the statutory duties. It's at Joint Appendix 1130 and 1131. We argue that they cannot use the as-is provisions to shirk their duties under the statute. That's what we argue. They can't get around the statutory duties.
What was the pleading in which you made that argument?
That was the opposition to the McDonald Party's motion for summary judgment, Your Honor. And that's the specific page number of where we were talking about. We are making a claim under NRS 645, and they cannot use the as-is provisions in that purchase agreement to contract around their statutory duty. That's what we argued, Your Honor. Even if we waived it, though, you still have the McIntosh standard. You still have the common law standard that says even in an as-is contract, you cannot use those provisions to get around disclosing material facts. You still have a duty to disclose material facts. And what you heard is a lot of facts. There's a lot of issues of fact as to whether the Rosenbergs could have discovered this information. And I also want to take note where counsel indicates, well, she might have known some of it. She knew all of it. She was involved. She was the person who represented Bank of America selling the property to the Rosenbergs. This is Dorian I'm referring to. She was the agent who sold the parcel to Malik, the original parcel he bought, the 594 Laramont. She was the individual involved in the sale of the golf parcel. McDonald Highlands and her agent were directly involved in the zoning, as this court already noted from the record. She was intimately involved in every single aspect of everything with regard to Malik and the Rosenbergs, and not once did she disclose, by the way, we sold one-third parcel of that golf course, and Malik intends to build his home there. Not once did she disclose that. And so that's what we're suing under, Your Honor. And under the McIntosh case, it clearly says that there's an issue of fact as to whether that knowledge was intimate to the agent and whether she should have disclosed it and it could have been apparent to the buyer. Finally, Your Honor, with respect to the...
When this issue about waiver was clearly specified in the answering brief on appeal, why didn't you all address that in the reply brief?
Your Honor, we did. We addressed the part where we argued it in at the motion for summary judgment based both in the transcript.
You maintained that you mentioned specifically 645.255 in your reply brief?
In our reply brief, yes, we mentioned that in our opening brief, we mentioned 645.255. And then they indicated, well, you didn't bring that up. And then that's when we raised the argument in both the oral argument and our opposition to McDonald Highlands, a transcript I just cited, where we were arguing a statutory duty. I didn't reiterate 255 probably in the reply brief because it was in the initial brief. But what I was pointing out is that it wasn't waived because we were arguing you cannot use these as-is provisions to contract around your statutory duty. Could I have better said it? Could I have used the term waived? Sure, hindsight being 2020, but we did argue it. But regardless of even if it's waived, you still have the McIntosh standard, and that was clearly argued, and we argued there'd be issues of fact. All of the things you heard from counsel about whether Mrs. Rosenberg could have discovered this zoning information, all of that is issues of fact. And you had the timeline correct, Your Honor. That zoning was only at the online at the city of Henderson, but she gave a disclosure that said, this is up to date as of 2010, and NRS Chapter 113 is 113070, requires that be updated every 6 months. So if they're giving a disclosure form that's still dated February 2010, the Rosenbergs have every right to believe that that is the most up-to-date zoning form. They had no reason, and yet all of this information was intimately known to McDonald's agent, and she never took the time to disclose it. Your Honor, I do want to address finally the semi-private.
Just before you leave that, I'm sorry, but doesn't McIntosh also suggest the Rosenbergs, I mean, these facts were also available to the Rosenbergs, and that there's some onus of diligent inquiry on their part? These are not things that were only known to McDonald's. There's a public record. These were on the website immediately after the meeting when the zoning change or those issues came up. What was alleged that was uniquely known to the broker that was not capable of determination by the Rosenbergs?
She uniquely knew that happened. In other words, there was no reason for the Rosenbergs. All their due diligence was leading up to buying the property. They researched this community, they narrowed it down to this street, this golf particular hole, and this golf course. And so all of that, they narrowed it down. They had no reason to believe that the golf course was changing in any way, shape, or form. That's the issue of fact. They're alleging that somehow that getting a zoning disclosure form that says this is up to date, and not being told anything changing about, there's nothing to indicate anything's changing.
It was up to date as of 2010,
right,
correct?
Right, but it has to be updated every 6 months under the statute. So if you're providing a form that says this has been the same zoning since 2010, there's nothing to indicate that it's been changed. That was her duty to, if there had been a change, that would have been an outdated form, and it would have been in violation of NRS Chapter 113 to even give that form.
Would you agree that it would have been readily ascertainable by a diligent investor to find this information outside of that form?
Only if they knew to look, Your Honor. That's the point. Only if they knew to look, and that would be the issue of fact before the jury. In other words, you'd have to have a jury say, you would have known to look for this, and if you looked for it, it still would have told you a parcel was sold. They still wouldn't have seen a parcel was sold to Malik, however, because that wasn't recorded until after they purchased their property. So it still wouldn't have told them anything other than a change in zoning. So that's the issue of fact. You have to go to whether a jury, a reasonable mind, is given that the plat map hadn't changed, the topography map hadn't changed, the map inside the office detailing all the lots for McDonald Highlands hadn't changed. You're getting a zoning disclosure. You're also getting a seller disclosure form that says no known future development next to the property is occurring and no other conditions that might materially affect the property's value. That's the disclosure form they were sent, and both of those questions were answered in the negative. So given that, the totality of those circumstances, a jury, reasonable minds could differ as to whether this was ascertainable when it was within the intimate knowledge of Dorian just to simply to disclose it. But that was cut off by the district court because the district court found as a matter of law that the as-is provisions waived both the common law and statutory duty. That's all we're asking for, is a chance to put this, these facts before a jury. Your Honors, finally, with respect to the McDonald parties, I do want to address the privacy of the golf course. Mr. McDonald testified it's a semi-public golf course, and I have his testimony right here. This is the Joint Appendix 353. I specifically asked Mr. McDonald whether the golf course was private, open to the public. I said, so in 2012, me having no affiliation with McDonald Highlands or even a hotel, could I come and play on Dragon Bridge? And he said, you could. And it goes on, you can read from page 14 all the way through 16 that Mr. McDonald is talking about this golf course being a semi-public golf course.
But I assume you have to pay to play golf, it's not free.
Of course, it's not free, but it is open to the public. Mr. McDonald testified that it had always been open to the public since its inception in 2000, so I wanted to correct that fact. Well, regardless though.
But that's different than an open space where the public would be free to walk on the golf course without paying or without being invited.
And that would be an issue of fact. They never argued that this was non-public space.
I asked you about the CCNRs and the design guidelines. Where in any document in this record is there a basis for establishing access to the golf course by the public, or for that matter, your clients, without similar to the facts in Scheer?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the CCNRs or the design guidelines that say golf course is public space. I'm going to agree with that. Where it aligns with Scheer is that it's platted that way. In other words, you sell the community as a whole. You don't just buy the four corners of 590 Laramont. The Rosenbergs bought into the whole entire community, just like anyone else did in McDonald, or just like someone does in a planned unit community of any part.
That's what I'm struggling with, and maybe you can help me out here. But if I buy that lot, what allows me to walk onto the ninth green, as I'm sure I would, and putt at night?
I don't know anything that prohibits it, Your Honor.
Well, wouldn't it be trespassing?
I don't know that to be true, Your Honor. There's nothing to suggest that you don't have...
No, did you offer anything in the record that indicates that your clients have anything other than the right to look down the fairway because of the juxtaposition of their home, as opposed to walking onto the golf course and putting in the evening?
I think, if I may answer that question, Your Honor, the problem with that is that that becomes an issue of fact. Now we're applying the Boyd elements. And none of the Boyd elements have anything to do with whether it's openly to the public or whether you can actually use it for any particular purpose. It just means it has to remain, in terms of its use, how you platted it. So let's say it's a park, it has to remain a park. Whether you had access to it or not, that's inconsequential in terms of what we're appealing here. The district court cut off any Boyd analysis. The counsel stood up here and went through an entire Boyd analysis, and yet the district court never made any of those findings, because he started from the premise that Nevada law doesn't even recognize an implied restrictive covenant, let alone a party's right to even bring such a claim. That's the error we're asking to be overturned. They can make all of those arguments to a jury, and then it may not impact whether a restrictive covenant exists. But this court did make it clear that this doctrine arises out of operation of law, but whether one exists is an issue of fact, and that's where we were cut off. So anytime they stood up here and tried to counter Scheer or Boyd factually, that's what goes to the jury. That's not what the district court did here. He completely discounted Boyd and Scheer from the factual perspective. He never looked to see if it was unity of ownership. He never looked to see if the property was open and continuous. And he never looked at the intent of the parties. He operated under the assumption that Nevada law doesn't recognize this doctrine, and therefore the Rosenbergs had no. And that's what we're asking to reverse the unity. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Court thanks Ms. Hanks and Mr. Shapiro and Mr. Jones for your challenging arguments on this case. This case will stand submitted.